recording the details, the less his people took ownership of their work and the ship. Not surprisingly, Benfold became one of the only ships in the history of the Navy to flunk its first engineering certification. Another consequence? Everything else on the ship began to go sour. I've seen the same thing over and over in my years as a leadership consultant. A pharmaceutical company I was working with promoted its best salesman to be head of sales. Instead of leading the sales force, he became the super salesman of the company. He had to be in on every deal, large or small. The other salespeople lost interest and stopped feeling as if they were in charge of their own jobs because they knew they couldn't make a deal without him there to close it. The super salesman would swoop in at the last minute, close the deal, claim all the glory, and the others were left feeling that they were just holding his bat. You have to train yourself in leadership, and you can't afford to wait until you get promoted to begin the process. While you're still an individual contributor, learn to think like your boss. So when the day comes to be a leader, you're ready to step right in with your game plan in hand. One of my main tasks was to keep Secretary Perry on schedule. Like all great leaders, he was truly disciplined. Once he approved the schedule that we proposed, he expected to stick to it down to the minute. Meetings started on time and ended on time, with resolution. No meeting was spent talking about the need for more meetings. Keeping him on schedule required reading his mind. Sometimes, however, I had to use brute force to get things done to Perry's liking. Senior military officers on the make would often try to extend their face time with Perry, schmoozing with them to enhance their careers. What they didn't realize was that he saw right through their crude tactics. For example, we were in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, scheduled to meet with the families of 5 Defense Department employees who had been killed the week before when a car bomb exploded outside their offices. Before seeing them, we were to be briefed on operations by a 2-star Air Force general. Although the briefing was important, Perry already had a firm grasp of the issues, and the briefing was less crucial than extending his condolences to the families. The general, however, used his very long briefing to promote himself. When he showed no signs of finishing, I cut in, announced the briefing was over, and we were off to meet the families. Secretary Perry left. The general took me by the arm and berated me, but I lit into him in a way that I had never done to a senior officer before. Sometimes desperate measures are needed when you are dealing with a sclerotic bureaucracy. The whole exercise in thinking like my bosses paid off when Secretary Perry had to fly to the Middle East for a series of crisis meetings on 6 hours' notice, and I had to arrange the whole trip. It happened on Labor Day weekend, 1996. My 2-star boss had been promoted, and his replacement had flown to Texas early that Friday morning to give his daughter away at her wedding. Secretary Perry was attending a routine breakfast meeting at the White House that was set to start at 8 a.m. and last an hour. But his security people didn't call at 9 to say he was on his way back to the Pentagon. When the call hadn't come by 9:30 or by 10 or by 10:30, people started getting nervous. They were sticking their heads into my office asking what was happening. Why wasn't the secretary back yet? And how could they rearrange his schedule without knowing? I knew there was trouble simmering in the Middle East. Saddam Hussein was repeatedly violating the sanctions the Gulf Coalition had imposed on Iraq after his 1990 invasion of Kuwait, and his troops were massing along the border again. But the coalition was showing signs of fraying. Some of the Arab nations were asking why we had to continue the sanctions. But it hadn't seemed anywhere near the crisis stage. Before he left for Texas, the general had told me we would probably be going to the Middle East to deal with the problem next week. What could go wrong? When the White House meeting kept going and going, I knew this was what it had to be about. Finally, the big white secure phone on my desk, the one that heats up when the top officials talk directly to each other, rang. The light showed that the call was coming from the White House. With my palms sweating, I picked it up. It was the first time I had answered the hotline from the president's office. "Mike, this is Bill Perry," he said, and I replied, "Dr. Perry, what time are we flying to the Middle East?" He said, you pick the time and get everything going. At a minimum, he told me, we would be visiting Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Bahrain, but he didn't know where we'd go first. By this time, Dr. Perry's scheduling secretary had figured out that something big was happening. She had rounded up his four senior staff members and sent them to my office. They were standing around while I said a lot of yes sirs, and then I hung up the hotline and told them, we're going to the Middle East tonight. One of them said, how are you going to do it? I had to laugh. These guys were all the civilian equivalents of four-star generals, and I was a lowly Navy commander making half their salaries. But they were standing there expecting me to take the lead. So I started giving them assignments, tasking them with all the things that had to be done to get on the road. And because I had learned to think like my bosses, I knew what those things were. There were considerable logistics, of course, arranging for planes and pilots, security and ground transportation in every country we might visit, and food for everyone in the group. But the organizing went beyond that. When a cabinet minister travels overseas, it usually takes months of preparation by the Undersecretary of Policy and his staff. They work with their overseas counterparts to set agendas and the points to be discussed, and often prepare the final communique in advance. Here it was just before noon, and we'd leave sometime in the evening, and somebody needed to get those people hopping to get in touch with their contacts around the world and keep them in the policy loop. So I told one of the senior civilians to fire up the undersecretary. The others got similar instructions as I delegated the pieces of the organizing job. The next call I made was to the Air Force Chief of Staff. The standard plane used for executive flights at the time was the Boeing 707, and I didn't want one of those for this trip. The 707 couldn't be refueled in the air, so we would have had to land three times for refueling on a trip to the Middle East. What's more, the 707 needed a long runway, at least 10,000 feet for landing. Dr. Perry liked to be flexible, and he had been experimenting with using one of the latest model C-17 cargo planes for his travels. The C-17 could land and take off from a 3,000-foot runway. It didn't have passenger quarters or the complex communications gear we would need, but we had set up two trailers, one with the communications equipment and the other with a conference room, passenger seats, a bunk, and even a shower. When the trailers were loaded into the hold of a C-17, it could be used to get to any trouble spot in a crisis. The Air Force called the trailers Silver Bullets because they looked just like the Airstream trailers you see in campgrounds. When you rely on equipment, there's always the possibility that it will break down. So I told the Air Force Chief of Staff that I needed five of his C-17s, one to fly us out of Andrews Air Force Base, and four more stationed at points in the Middle East, Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Ankara in Turkey, which had been added to the list of possible destinations. Since pilots are allowed to fly only 14 hours without rest, and this trip would take longer, I needed an extra rested crew at Andrews, and the four planes in the Middle East must all have rested crews as well. We needed aerial refueling at three points along the route. So the Air Force Chief of Staff located the five planes and all the crews, landed them where we needed them, and put the pilots into crew rest. As it happened, the Silver Bullet with the communications gear was being flown from South Carolina to New Jersey, and it was passing over Washington while I was calling. So I said, land it at Andrews. It couldn't have worked out any better. As the day wore on, the group going on the trip kept growing. I had to arrange food for them, set up security and ground transportation at all the destinations, and make sure medical care would be available if anyone needed it. At one point, I realized that I would be going along, and I hadn't packed. I didn't have time to go home, so I gave my keys to a sergeant in the office and told him to go to my place and pack my suitcase with my uniform, shaving gear, and other essentials. Another time, the Saudi embassy in Washington called in a panic. The ambassador's number two man had to be in Saudi Arabia for the meetings, and the only way he could get there was to fly with us. We had never taken a foreign official on our plane, but Dr. Perry said it wouldn't be a problem. Then it hit me that I hadn't done anything about another of Dr. Perry's casual instructions. On the way home from the trip on Monday, Labor Day, he wanted to brief the defense ministers of France and Great Britain on how the crisis was being resolved. I was supposed to get them to rearrange their schedules to meet with him. He didn't care whether the meeting was in France or Britain, but one of the ministers would have to fly out of his country for the occasion. Great Britain had a wonderful defense attaché, Rear Admiral Tom Blackburn. He and I hit it off, and I really respected him. So I called him at the British Embassy and said, "I need your help. I'm drowning here. Can you set up these meetings?" He called his minister and arranged everything. As it turned out, we did the briefing on our C-17 on a runway at a Royal Air Force base outside of London. When we took off from Andrews at about 9 p.m., we still didn't know where we were going to land. It would be in Saudi Arabia, but the Minister of Defense was in Riyadh and the King was in Jeddah, and we didn't know where the first meeting would be held. We met tanker planes three times for aerial refueling, and with only 2 hours left before we reached Saudi Arabia, I told Dr. Perry I needed to know whether we were landing in Riyadh or Jeddah. He said he wanted to land at Prince Sultan Air Base at Al Kharj. It was brand new, and he wanted to see it for himself. I said that wasn't an option, that we had no security set up there, or a motorcade, or even landing permission. He said we'll go there anyway. He was on a critical national security mission, and we'd been up all night in meetings, discussing how it was going to play out, but he was also multitasking. He needed to inspect this new base personally to make sure our airmen and soldiers would be secure. So I saluted, but there was literally no time for preparations. By the time I reached the base commander on the phone, we were on our final approach. The commander showed up in his own car to pick up the Secretary of Defense, and it was a totally impromptu come-as-you-are visit. It turned out that the commander had done everything right, an outstanding job, and Dr. Perry was thoroughly satisfied. After 2 or 3 hours in the ground, we went on to Riyadh in a meeting with the Minister of Defense at about 2 in the morning. The Saudis like to sleep in the heat of the day and do their meetings at night anyway, but by then we were exhausted. We grabbed a couple hours of sleep before flying on to Jeddah to meet with the King. On the way to Jeddah, Dr. Perry was multitasking again. He was in the cockpit with the pilots because he wanted to understand the avionics of the new C-17s. On the runway at Jeddah, he saw the other C-17 I had on standby there, and he looked at me and said, "Mike, there are only 10 of these planes anywhere. What are the odds on another one being here?" I never told him I had set that up with 3 more along the route. He didn't have to know. It wasn't something he needed to worry about. My job was to make sure the secretary's mind was free to think about the big problems and that he didn't have to give a thought to how to get there or what was next on his schedule. I wanted to lift every other burden off his shoulders. I even called his wife for him from time to time to let her know what we were doing because he didn't have time to call her himself. My role was to create the conditions in which the policymakers could do their work. I wanted to be like a helmsman, working so deftly, maneuvering the ship in difficult conditions that the skipper never has to tell me which way to move the rudder or how far to move it. In all, during those 3 days, we touched down in 5 countries, Kuwait, Bahrain, Turkey, twice in Saudi Arabia, and finally Great Britain. Dr. Perry did his job. The coalition held firm, and Saddam Hussein backed down, and I didn't get one rudder order on the entire trip. I followed the same principle in my next job, commanding Benfold. I wanted my bosses to know that I was on the job and they didn't have to worry about me, that they could spend their time on more important matters. If your bosses see you lifting burdens off their shoulders, and they find out they can trust you, they stay out of your face, and that gives you the freedom you need to operate independently and improve your ship. Chapter 3. Lead by Example. While the image of a Navy captain conjures up gold braid and firmly barked orders, neither makes a leader. A leader will never accomplish what he or she wants by ordering it done. Real leadership must be done by example, not precept. Whether you like it or not, your people follow your example. They look to you for signals, and you have enormous influence over them. If they see you fail to implement a policy you disagree with, they may think they have a green light to do the same. If they see you not telling the truth, they may feel free to lie as well. Likewise, if they see you challenge outdated business practices, they will follow suit. Doing so will become ingrained in the culture. Whenever an officer proposed a plan, I asked, "Why do we have to do it that way? Is there a better way?" So they always searched for better ways before coming to me. The signals you send are important. You train your crew how to operate through every decision you make and every action you take. It's funny how often the problem is you. Whenever I could not get the results I wanted, I swallowed my temper and turned inward to see if I was part of the problem. I asked myself three questions. Did I clearly articulate the goals? Did I give people enough time and resources to accomplish the task? Did I give them enough training? I discovered that 90% of the time, I was at least as much a part of the problem as my people were. I first learned that lesson in the Philippines when I was Admiral Webster's aide. Each admiral has his own so-called barge, a nice yacht that can be used for entertaining or just for cruising. Webster had a beautiful barge, and as his aide, I was in charge of it, but I had no staff to maintain it. One day shortly after we both got to Subic Bay, he decided to take the barge out. I commandeered a couple of sailors from one of the ships in port to staff it, and the admiral and I cruised out to an island off the bay. But on the way back, the boat broke down. We were adrift in the harbor for about an hour. Then our radio died. The admiral said, "Take my flag down." When an admiral was on any kind of boat or ship, it flies his flag. And Admiral Webster didn't want anyone to know he was out there helpless. You can only imagine how humiliated I was. Finally, a garbage barge came by and I waved it down. The garbage men threw us a rope and towed us back into port as the admiral fumed in the cabin below. I never saw the admiral as upset as he was that day, and I really felt the heat. I had plenty of excuses. I didn't have the crew or the tools to run the thing properly. But at the end of the day, I was responsible. I should have been more prepared. Needless to say, for the rest of my term, I put great effort into maintaining his barge, and we never had trouble again. I have repeatedly learned and relearned that lesson of preparedness over the years, and there seems to be no end of ways to fail. My most vivid recollection dates back to 1994, when I was the XO of Shiloh. A sailor had fallen asleep while standing watch. This is an extremely egregious offense, because people can get killed if you are not alert. The young sailor was placed on report. Think of it as being charged with a crime. And I had to decide whether to send the case to the judge, the commanding officer, or dismiss the charge. Well, this was an open and shut case. If you are asleep on watch, you are guilty. There was no need to bother with the facts. So I sent the sailor to the captain for punishment without any further investigation. To my utter surprise, the captain asked the sailor why he had fallen asleep on watch. The sailor said he had been up all night cleaning a dirty workspace. Why did he have to stay up to clean it? Because the chief told him it had to be done by 8 a.m. Chief, why didn't you give him more time to get it done? Because the division officer told me it had to be done. I immediately saw where this was heading and started to sweat. The captain turned to the division officer, who turned to the department head. By this time, I was standing in a puddle, who turned to me and said, "The XO told me to get it done by 8 a.m. How in the world could I have known that they were so short-handed that they would have to keep somebody up all night to get it finished? But, in fact, I should have known, or at least been approachable enough for the officers to feel safe explaining to me why it was a problematic order. I didn't get all the facts. I didn't realize that there were not enough resources to get the job done in the time I had allowed. The captain dismissed the case, and I felt like a complete uncaring idiot. Never again, I promised myself, would I give an order without clearly articulating the goal, providing the time and resources to get it done, and ensuring that my crew had the proper training to do it right. But of course, there would be a next time. You never know all the things you should know. Never forget your effect on people. Leaders need to understand how profoundly they affect people, how their optimism and pessimism are equally infectious, how directly they set the tone and spirit of everyone around them. How many times have you gone into your boss's office and felt smaller? For example, she is working on email and doesn't even acknowledge your presence. Or the boss is talking to you and keeps interrupting to pick up the phone, because the phone is more important than talking to you. Or worse yet, he belittles you or your efforts. Mediocre leaders don't even take the trouble to know their people. I learned of an incident between my predecessor on Benfold and then seaman Blaine Alexander of Texas. It was near the end of the captain's tour when he stopped Blaine in the passageway and asked if he was new to the ship. Now, Blaine was one of the first to report to Benfold as she was being built and had suffered through 2 years under that captain. But, he answered with a straight face, "Why, yes, sir, I am. And what is it that you do aboard the ship?" My predecessor then fingered his gold command at sea pin and said, "Do you see this pin? This means I'm the commanding officer of this ship." Blaine explained that it was a pleasure to meet him. Several sailors who witnessed this exchange almost split their guts laughing. As a manager, the one signal you need to steadily send to your people is how important they are to you. In fact, nothing is more important to you. Realize your influence and use it wisely. Be there for your people. Find out who they are. Recognize the effects you have on them and how you can make them grow taller. When I left Benfold, I went to work for the Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command in San Diego, the high-tech arm of the Navy. I was the deputy to one of the senior civilian executives. Whenever he could not attend the Monday Board of Directors meeting, I was tagged to take his place. These meetings were difficult because the senior admiral who ran them could not bear criticism, especially if it involved his immediate staff. If you pointed out deficiencies in his operation, his defenses hit the panic button and he wound up fighting with everyone in the room. I don't think he understood the silencing effect he had on people when he lashed out at them. His message was clear: my operation is perfect, no need for improvement. Although he is hugely talented, his response to criticism was keeping us from addressing deep-seated problems in the organization. I tried to think of some way to help. I decided to send him a private email in which I quietly described how his outbursts stifled progress and cast a pall over the discussions. I suggested that he consider trying to control his emotions. Guess what? I got an email back from him saying, "You're absolutely right. I didn't realize the effect I was having on people. Now that you have pointed it out, I will be a lot more restrained." And he actually started to improve. If I had confronted him in public, the results would have been devastating. I had nothing to gain and everything to lose by emailing the admiral, which in itself is a key to my success in challenging senior people. I made it clear that my only agenda was helping the Navy improve, with all due credit to my superiors, not to myself. If I were viewed as a self-promoter, I would have been squashed long before I had a chance to command a ship. It helps when your motives are pure and you make sure they come across that way. It is well known that every leader sets the tone for his or her organization. Show me an enthusiastic leader and I will show you an enthusiastic workforce, and vice versa. If the leader has a bad day, the whole organization has a bad day. But what do you do on the days when you just can't be cheerful and positive? The key is to minimize the damage you impose. My crew called it the dark side. A ship at sea is a 24/7 operation, and I am always on call if problems arise. The officers noticed that the more I was called during the night and the less sleep I got, the crankier I was the next day. They kept track of how often I was called, and if it was four or more times in one night, or if I had to get out of my bunk to supervise something, they knew the next day would not be pleasant. I later found out that after Reveille, 6 a.m., word would spread about how often I had been awakened. After one sleepless night, a 19-year-old sailor came up to me as I was sitting on the bridge wing chair and said, "Captain, word has it that the dark side is going to be out today." I still chuckle over that incident. The lesson to be learned, though, is that everybody has a dark side. And the more you understand it, the better you can manage it. I decided to minimize interaction with my crew on days when the dark side was evident. so that at least I would do no harm. No one follows a leader who lies. One of my most vivid lessons in bad leadership was when I was an ensign on my first ship, the frigate USS Albert David. We were off the coast of the Philippines, doing a gunnery exercise with a huge target made of concrete and steel, filled with air pockets that kept it afloat. Three ships had been shooting at it all day long. Even though we scored some direct hits, the thing would not sink. It was nearly sunset, and we were pretty close to civilian shipping lanes. We could not leave the target drifting around. It was a hazard to navigation. We had to sink it somehow. The Commodore, who was embarked on our ship, was getting frustrated. So he ordered my commanding officer to come alongside the target, put some gunnery people on it, and then set charges to blow up the target. The commanding officer handled the ship badly and accidentally ran over the target. The massive thing disappeared underneath us, scraped the entire hull from stem to stern, and finally smashed the propeller as it surfaced again. Still, the target had not sunk and had to be blown up by hand. All of this might have been funny had we not damaged the ship's underwater sonar dome as well as its propeller. Three of its five blades were so badly mangled that the entire propeller had to be replaced. When we limped back to port at Subic Bay, the Commodore filed a report maintaining that he had first heard about the damage from one of the other ships. One of their sonarmen heard our propeller clanking, he wrote. The Admiral immediately asked how it happened. Both the Commodore and our commanding officer said they had no idea. They acted mystified, as if some sea monster attacked our ship. It was the most barefaced lie I had ever heard, up till then anyway. Everyone on our ship knew how the propeller got damaged, and also knew that our two senior officers had lied. The damage cost millions of dollars. The ship had to be put in dry dock and the sonar dome repaired. A new propeller had to be fabricated and flown in from the United States and then installed in the dry dock. The entire ship and crew were out of action for 6 weeks. Equally bad, if not worse, the commanding officer heard that one of our junior officers had told the real story to a friend on the Admiral's staff. The commanding officer went ballistic. Very publicly in front of others, he threatened to punch our junior officer in the mouth. Veins bulged in his neck and forehead, his fists clenched. And though he restrained himself, he clearly sent a message. The truth is situational. All too often, that's what happens when an accident occurs. Everyone tries to put the best spin on it. But cover-ups always fail. Sooner or later, the truth comes out. We then blame the fewest possible alleged culprits in the most junior ranks, put them on trial, and punish them. Whatever actually caused the accident in the first place is seldom rectified. It would be far better if we developed a culture that allowed people to tell the truth. Certainly, it would be more useful to focus on making sure the accident never happened again, rather than on finding someone to blame. Instead, we have a culture that repeatedly shows the lower ranks how the upper ranks lie or evade the obvious truth to avoid blame and save their careers. Never fail the Washington Post test. When I took over Benfold, there was no doubt I wanted it to be the best ship in the history of the Navy. But it was also important for me to get there the right way. I was always careful never to take any ethical shortcuts. The test was simple, and it allowed me to decide whether to go or stop in terms of obvious consequences. I just asked myself this: if what I'm about to do appeared on the front page of the Washington Post tomorrow, would I be proud or embarrassed? If I knew I would be embarrassed, I would not do it. If I'd be proud, I knew I was generally on the right track. Getting somewhere is important. How you get there is equally important. And however unsophisticated it seems, as I have said before, the Sunday school standard is enough. Do the right thing. Forget petty politics. Don't worry about whether you're going to upset anyone or ruffle anyone's feathers. If it is the right thing to do, figure out a way to get past the egos, a way to get around the bureaucratic infighting, and then do it. Often, even in hindsight, you can't be 100% sure that you did the right thing. When in doubt, go with your gut. I did that for one of my officers on Benfold, and I'm glad I did. Because everyone is needed in combat, nobody gets annual leave while a ship is at sea. The one exception is for sailors with critically ill family members. We fly people home for that. We usually don't let people go home for the birth of a child, but one of my most important officers asked me to make an exception. His wife was due to deliver 3 days after he left San Diego for the Persian Gulf, which meant that if he left, he would miss the critical exercise we were planning to perform on the way to Honolulu. I agonized over this for a long time. Many men had missed the births of their children, and I didn't want to give an officer a break that I could not give to the crew. Finally, I decided I would take the risk. From the Navy's point of view, it probably wasn't a good decision. And in fact, I think my second in command had talked me into it. 4 days after we left, the baby was born in critical condition, and whether he would live remained unclear for an entire month. In Navy terms, it was now a justifiable leave since the baby was in critical condition. The officer didn't miss just a week of sea duty, but a full 6 weeks. As I look back, I am eternally thankful that he was there to help his wife and newborn son. We did the right thing by that officer, and the young boy who is now 16 years old is flourishing. His father is now in command of his own destroyer. And if the whole story had been printed in the Washington Post, I would not have been one bit ashamed. I also changed the policy on leaves for birth. From now on, both officers and enlisted personnel would be flown home for the birth of a child unless we were actually in combat. Obey, even when you disagree. Every so often, your chain of command comes up with a policy that you disagree with. Yet, it's your responsibility to enforce it. It's important to make your objections known in a private manner with your bosses. But if you lose your argument, it's also important that you carry out that order as if you supported it 100%. This discipline is crucial in battle, of course. A captain's orders can't be ignored. They're vital for saving lives or ships. If I have a missile coming at me, and I give the order to fire, I need to have the utmost confidence that my crew will carry out the order without delay. It's important that you not undermine your superiors. In any organization, your people need to know that you support your chain of command. If they see you freelancing, they will feel free not to support you when they disagree with your policies. After hearing my sea stories and leadership notions, some people assume that I spent my Navy career flouting authority and toying with slow-witted admirals. Nothing could be further from the truth. I was neither a maverick nor a managerial guerrilla. I operated entirely within the parameters laid out for naval officers. I had command of my own ship, but at the end of the day, I was nothing more than a mid-level manager in a 400,000-person organization. That I had strong feelings about the Navy's personnel policies and hoped I could contribute to their being changed doesn't mean that I harbored fantasies that I could change them all by myself. No, the best course was to make the most of what I was given. A chain of command that led upward toward the people, actually empowered to enact my ideas once they accepted them. When I was given a task I did not agree with, I would sometimes ask my people if they thought there was a better way to accomplish the goals that my boss had set. There is nothing wrong with trying to offer a better way to meet a requirement that has been imposed on you. My superiors appreciated my honesty. If I could come up with an improvement, they usually listened to me. In the end, they got credit for the accomplishment, which suited me just fine. It gave them the best possible reason for doing what I wanted to do. Chapter 4. Listen aggressively. My education and leadership really began when I was in Washington watching William Perry in action. He was universally loved and admired by heads of state, by ministers of defense and foreign affairs, and by our own and our allies' troops. A lot of that was because of the way he listened. Each person who talked to him had his complete, undivided attention. Everyone blossomed in his presence because he was so respectful. And I realized I wanted to affect people the same way. Perry became my role model. But that wasn't enough to change my leadership style. Something bigger had to happen. And it did. It was painful but crucial for my realization that listening doesn't always come naturally to me. Perry opened my eyes to how often I just pretended to hear people. How many times, I asked myself, had I barely glanced up from my work when a subordinate came into my office? I wasn't paying attention. I was marking time until it was my turn to give orders. That revelation led me to a new personal goal. Shortly after I took command of Benfold, I vowed to treat every encounter with every person on the ship as the most important thing at that moment. It wasn't easy for me, and I didn't do it perfectly, but my crew's enthusiasm and smart ideas kept me going. See the ship through the crew's eyes. It didn't take me long to realize that my young crew was smart, talented, and full of good ideas that frequently came to nothing because no one in charge had ever listened to them. Like most organizations, the Navy seemed to put managers in a transmitting mode, which minimized their receptivity. They were conditioned to promulgate orders from above, not to welcome suggestions from below. I decided that my job was to listen aggressively and to pick up every good idea the crew had for improving the ship's operation. Some traditionalists might consider this heresy, but it's actually just common sense. After all, the people who do the nuts and bolts work on a ship constantly see things that officers don't. It seemed to me only prudent for the captain to work hard at seeing the ship through the crew's eyes. My first step was trying to learn the names of everyone on board. It wasn't easy. Try attaching 310 names to 310 faces in 1 month. At 2 o'clock one morning, I woke up suddenly and said to myself, the only way I can create the right climate is to tell every sailor in person that this is the climate I want to create. I decided to interview each crew member on the ship so he or she could hear my expectations directly. I raced to work that morning, and without informing my chain of command, I began to interview 5 crew members a day, one at a time. I didn't know where I was headed when I started the interviews. I just knew I was desperate to set a different tone. I started with very basic questions: their names, where they were from, their marital status, did they have children? If so, what were their names? In time, I came to know not only my crew's names, but those of their spouses as well. Then I asked about Benfold. What did they like most, least? What would they change if they could? I tried to establish a personal relationship with each crew member. I wanted to link our goals so that they could see my priority of improving Benfold as an opportunity for them to apply their talents and give their jobs a real purpose. My interviews included more detailed questions. Did they have special memories from high school? How about from their hometown? I asked if they had goals for their time in the Navy. What about for the future? I always asked them why they had joined the Navy. Until this point, I never knew why people signed up. I learned by listening that 50% enlisted because their families could not afford to send them to college, and 30% joined to get away from bad situations at home. Drugs, gangs, and other violence, for example. Some of their stories broke my heart. One sailor was raised by a distant relative after his parents were killed in a car accident when he was very young. Another grew up in a neighborhood where gunfire at night was not an uncommon occurrence. Yet another sailor's family were immigrants who arrived in this country with nothing and worked any jobs they could to support their children. In just about every case, my sailors were not born with anything remotely resembling a silver spoon in their mouths. But each and every one of them was trying to make something meaningful of their lives. This is one of the greatest strengths of our all-volunteer military force. They are all good, young, hard-working men and women. They deserve nothing but our respect and admiration. Something happened in me as a result of those interviews. I came to respect my crew enormously. No longer were they nameless bodies at which I barked orders. I realized that they were just like me. They had hopes, dreams, loved ones, and they wanted to believe that what they were doing was important, and they wanted to be treated with respect. I became their biggest cheerleader. How can you treat people poorly when you know and respect them? How can you put people down when you realize that the journey they are on will not only improve the workplace and help you, but will improve society as well? I enjoyed helping them figure out what they wanted in life and charting a course to get there. Most of these sailors had never been in a commanding officer's cabin before, but once they saw that the invitation was sincere, the response was overwhelming. I had a microphone for the ship's public address system on my desk. Whenever I got a good suggestion, I hit the button and told the whole ship about it. I didn't have to go through a management committee. The turnaround time for launching a good idea was about 5 minutes. From those conversations, I compiled two lists of all the jobs performed on the ship. List A consists of all our mission-critical tasks. On List B were all our non-value-added chores, the dreary, repetitive stuff, such as chipping and painting. I tackled List B with gusto. One sailor I interviewed early on reminded me that we repainted the ship 6 times a year. Every other month, my youngest sailors, the ones I most wanted to connect with, had to spend entire days sanding down rust and repainting the ship. It was a huge waste of time and effort, mental as well as physical, and a drain on morale to boot. The sailor suggested a better way. Use stainless steel bolts and nuts to replace the ferrous metal ones that streaked rust down the sides of the ship. Great idea, I said. Then we checked the Navy supply system. Sorry, no stainless steel fasteners in stock. Pushing the envelope, we scoured the globe and used the ship's credit card to pick up thousands of dollars worth of stainless steel fasteners. Once installed, they got us out of painting for nearly a year. By the way, the entire Navy has now adopted stainless steel fasteners for installation on every ship. Next, we investigated every piece of removable metal that was topside on the ship and was susceptible to corrosion. There was a relatively new process for preserving the metal that involved baking it to remove surface impurities, then flame spraying it with a rust-inhibiting paint. This highly effective process was already in use by the Navy, but the facilities to do it were so small that it was impossible to treat even a fraction of what was required. So we found a steel finishing company in San Diego that could do the job. The entire process cost $25,000, and the paint job was guaranteed to last for years. The sailors never touched a paintbrush again. With more time to learn their jobs, they began boosting readiness indicators all over the ship. The Navy has since dramatically increased the capacity to do this for every ship. Find round people for round holes. The interviews gave me the data that enabled me to match my crew members' personal and professional goals with the tasks that needed to be done. Sometimes you have tasks that don't fit traditional job descriptions. When I searched the database in my head, I realized I had someone whose interests dovetailed with a particular assignment. Knowing my people well was a huge asset, a lever that helped them do well, even when performing onerous jobs. I began learning that lesson while I was the executive officer aboard USS Shiloh. The job is one of the most dreaded in the Navy because, in addition to being second in command, the XO is also in charge of the entire bureaucracy and paperwork for the ship. Shiloh had a crew of 440 people, which means evaluations, performance records, training records, pay records, medical records, dental records, and records about records for 440 people. I shudder to think how many trees die per year just to support the paper requirements for one ship. My main admin assistant was a fellow who got promoted only because he had been around longer than anybody else. He could not type, could not proofread, and could not use a spell checker. And the few things he could do, he did very slowly. One day he went on vacation, leaving me adrift in a sea of paper that had more errors than you could imagine. But then, a junior seaman, David Lauer, 21, arrived on board. He had been transferred from the ship's administrative office because he could not fit in. Worse, this young man had recently been charged with insubordination. So I expected little or nothing, hoping against hope that he could somehow reduce the administrative mess and free me up for the real mission of a guided missile cruiser, combat readiness. I met him and briefly explained his duties to him. Soon after, I saw that piles of fitness reports and training records were moving from the disheveled corner of my stateroom to the 4-signature box on my desk. Miraculously, the stacks of paper were disappearing. Words were spelled correctly. Sentences actually had subjects and verbs the first time. And I found myself handling paperwork only once. I was dumbstruck. One day I asked David why he had been kicked out of the administrative office. "I feel as though the chief petty officer hates me," he replied. He explained that within a month of reporting to the ship, he was suggesting ways of improving the efficiency and processes of the office, and the chief didn't like it. After hitting brick walls over and over again because of his junior rank, David had just given up and decided that it was no use. Well, this was just the kind of independent thinker I needed, and I made him my principal assistant, bypassing 5 more senior people. Eventually, David would come to me with an officer's fitness report and say, "XO, wouldn't this sound better if you changed this paragraph to this?" And usually, he'd already have it changed for me to sign right there. Give me performance over seniority any day of the week. Use the power of word magic. It would be difficult for me to overstate William Perry's influence on me. He helped me grow dramatically, both as a leader and as a person. The second important lesson he taught me was about the power of language to affect morale. If leaders back their words with action, if they practice what they preach, their words create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Call it word magic. In 1996, when China was amassing missiles to shoot at Taiwan, we sent 2 aircraft carrier battle groups to the region. Secretary Perry happened to be testifying on Capitol Hill, and a senator asked him about the buildup. As part of his response, he said he wasn't worried because we had the best damn Navy in the world. It was reportedly a huge vote of confidence and a morale boost for the Navy, which had been lurching from one mishap to the next. The words became Perry's catchphrase. I decided Benfold was going to be the best damn ship in that Navy. I repeated it to my sailors all the time, and eventually they believed it themselves. I told them I wanted them to greet every visitor who came on board by looking him or her in the eye, shaking hands, smiling, and saying, "Welcome to the best damn ship in the Navy." Visitors loved it. They would make a special effort to search me out and tell me what a wonderful experience it was to deal with my crew. For me, that's how you increase market share and make your business grow. If we were alongside another ship, we'd turn on the PA system and broadcast a greeting from the best damn ship in the Navy. To be truthful, no ship is ever designated the best in the Navy, so some of the other ships resented the boast. But I wanted my people to believe in themselves. Sure, it was corny, but it worked, because confidence is infectious. If we weren't actually the best just yet, we were certainly on our way there. We had another saying on the ship: "The sun always shines on Benfold." People began to believe that too. Chapter 5. Communicate purpose and meaning. The whole secret of leading a ship or managing a company is to articulate a common goal that inspires a diverse group of people to work hard together. That's what my sailors got: a purpose that transformed their lives and made Benfold a composite of an elite school, a lively church, a winning football team, and best of all, the hottest go-to ship in the U.S. Navy. When I took command, I kept walking around the ship trying to understand why everything seemed so desperately wrong, why there was no energy anywhere. It finally hit me that people were just showing up to collect a paycheck every 2 weeks. They were locking their passion and enthusiasm inside their cars in the parking lot and just bringing their bodies to work. I wanted them to be energized when they came aboard. I wanted them to have as much fun from 9 to 5 every day at work as they did from 5 to 9 every night at home. I realized what was missing. No one had ever thought to give them a compelling vision of their work, a good reason to believe it was important. After all, we dedicate 60 to 70% of our waking hours to this thing called work. It would be terrible if we didn't believe that what we were doing made a difference. So we spent some time in thought and came up with a compelling vision that they could believe in. We began making improvements, and slowly they stopped leaving their enthusiasm in their cars and began bringing it to work. make your crew think, we can do anything. On Benfold, we used every possible means of communication, including private email to key superiors, daily newsletters for the crew, my own cheerleading for good ideas, and walking around the ship chatting, and topside light shows and loud music that expressed Benfold's exuberance. We also issued a steady stream of readiness missives for tasks that ranged from air defense to sea blockades. When we were leaving the Persian Gulf after our 100-day tour of duty, Vice Admiral Tom Fargo, commander of the Persian Gulf's 5th Fleet, took me aside and said I was the only commanding officer who ever wrote 10-page messages on how to improve our procedures. He also said that these messages were the only ones he ever got that were worth reading from beginning to end. Our whole ship became a medium, sending a message of achievement and can-do optimism to the entire fleet. Unlike my former commander, who chewed people out publicly, I often used the Benfold's PA system to praise people, share new ideas, explain our goals, and keep everyone working together for a common cause. I used the PA system so much that I later found out that the crew called me Mega Mike. They said I never met a microphone I could resist talking into. Like any other workforce, mine appreciated hearing from top management. That communication is another thing missing for many organizations today. Managerial silence seems to be growing just when fierce competition is forcing companies to reinvent themselves constantly. Change frightens workers, and their fears thrive in silence. The antidote is obvious. Keep talking. Tell everyone personally what's in store for him or her. New goals, new work descriptions, new organizational structure, and yes, job losses, if that's the case. Explain why the company is making the changes. People can absorb anything if they are not deceived or treated arrogantly. Lies and arrogance create an us-versus-them atmosphere that poisons productivity. I decided that before I launched any big new policy, I would ask myself how my sailors saw it. If it made sense from that vantage, I probably had a pretty good policy. If it made no sense, I either had the wrong policy or I wasn't communicating clearly. If I had communicated clearly, people would understand before they got involved why a new policy was in everyone's best interest, which was how we got the crew's 100% support for nearly every change we made. Some leaders feel that by keeping people in the dark, they maintain a measure of control. But that is a leader's folly and an organization's failure. Secrecy spawns isolation, not success. Knowledge is power, yes, but what leaders need is collective power, and that requires collective knowledge. I found that the more people knew what the goals were, the better buy-in I got, and the better results we achieved together. Open up the clogged channels. As I rose through the ranks in the Navy, I was continually frustrated by how information was stopped at mid-level regions. I knew that messages being passed down the chain of command would often be stopped on the way so that people on the bottom didn't get the word. They continued doing what they thought was required, only to be chewed out. Nothing could be more irritating. I decided that when I took command, I would focus on creating communication that actually conveyed information. My reasoning was selfish and simple. There was a direct relationship between how much the crew knew about a plan and how well they carried it out. That in turn brought better results and helped us become more combat ready. Sometimes the communications problems were serious, and one equipment snafu nearly scuppered the whole Gulf fleet in our Iraqi crisis of 1997. Of all the communications triumphs during my Benfold years, I'm proudest of the work of Radioman First Class John Rafalco from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. By thinking out of the box, Rafalco single-handedly unclogged that monstrous blockage. By 1997, the way Navy ships communicated at sea had fallen far behind the digital revolution. Although the military services were the first to use satellites for communication, we never foresaw the quantum increase in the need for information. One of the main deficiencies in the 1991 Desert Storm operation against Saddam Hussein was our inability to get huge amounts of information to those on the front lines. We had never invested in increasing the pipeline capacity. The system was certainly secure. You could send top-secret information because, unlike internet transmissions, the material was highly encrypted. Unfortunately, the pipelines clogged up with urgent messages that never got delivered. During the Iraqi crisis of 1997, this backlog developed to the point that at any given time, as many as 7,000 operational messages might go astray or just stop moving. Some didn't reach their destinations for as many as 5 or 6 days, leaving captains out of the loop. Some messages were lost altogether. People on our leading air defense ship were so frustrated with the logjam that they began using a commercial satellite system to transmit encrypted data at a cost of $10.50 a minute. The irony was that Benfold and many other ships had been equipped with a new satellite system designed for voice communication and the rapid data transmission needed for launching Tomahawks. Unfortunately, how this system worked was somewhat of a mystery to most radio operators, none of whom had been trained to use it properly, much less capitalize on its capabilities. Enter Benfold's radioman, John Rafalco. John spent hours reading all the technical manuals on the new system. Then he told me it could solve all our communications problems for the entire Persian Gulf. This was definitely news that I felt the three-star admiral needed yesterday. But, adhering to my principle of working within the system, we first reported Rafalco's idea to the two-star admiral's chief of staff for communications, who didn't think it would work. The chief of staff indicated he was concerned that implementing the idea would divert needed manpower, and he didn't feel comfortable using the system for a different purpose from that for which it was designed. 6 weeks later, with the Leviathans of the U.S. fleet on the verge of becoming incommunicado, I went ahead and sent the two-star admiral, my battle group commander, an urgent message detailing the need for Rafalco's idea and explaining why I thought it would work. He bought into it, ordering the idea put into action immediately. In no time, we were flying John Rafalco all over the Gulf to train other ships to use the system. He became our jet-setting superstar, whom we were extremely proud of. Our first-class petty officer calmly updated all the gold-braided communications experts. The new system kicked right in and worked perfectly. The backlog problem disappeared virtually overnight. The system's pipes were so big and transmission was so clear that you could send oceans of messages. Ships suddenly communicated with one another around the clock without a glitch. My only role in this saga was to listen to Rafalco, appreciate his idea, and do my best to press it once I was convinced it was a good one. The force of his talent and thinking did everything else. My only regret was that I was not more forceful sooner in pushing his idea through. This is an example of a time when I should have bypassed the bureaucracy and not tolerated a 6-week delay. What this one radioman did for the Navy was phenomenal. He pulled us out of a crisis in wartime and exponentially increased our effectiveness throughout the Persian Gulf and the world. When we returned to San Diego, we were asked to debrief the commander of the Third Fleet, a three-star admiral. This top-level meeting consisted only of senior officers and John Rafalco. Since it was his idea, I took him along to explain it. I was never more proud of anyone than when young Rafalco became the teacher and the three-star became the pupil. The admiral was clearly impressed with John's description of his new procedure. In Benfold's Navy, talent knows no rank. When he left Benfold, John Rafalco wasn't allowed to fade back into obscurity. The White House quickly grabbed him to help ensure state-of-the-art communications for the President of the United States. John's story proves that no matter how fantastic your message is, if no one is receiving it, you aren't communicating. You must have mastery of all means of communication, along with the willingness to use them. Otherwise, you're just talking to yourself. After creating a great brand, defend it. While we were in the Persian Gulf, my crew of 310 built a collective reputation that made Benfold the star ship of the Fifth Fleet. Everything we did, from empowering sailors to sharpshooting Tomahawk missiles, seemed to become a fleet news event that dominated our admiral's morning briefing. Modesty fails to prevent me from savoring those heady times.